What's up, guys? This is Tony Angus. Welcome to Chat Time, where I have a conversation with interesting people about the world we live in and the things that matter to us most. Join me each week for a sometimes fun, sometimes controversial, sometimes enlightening, but always enjoyable chat. Today I'm speaking with Leslie Whiteside. Leslie's a qualified psychologist and mediator. She's also the owner and principal consultant at Edge Consulting, an organization that provides corporate training in areas such as conflict management, resilience, emotional intelligence, leadership, and equity and diversity. Leslie is an absolute wealth of knowledge and experience and a wonderful communicator, and I think you'll get a lot out of the podcast. Please give it up for Leslie Whiteside. Hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Thank you for joining me. Liz, your background's in psych.
Yes. I completed my psych degree, and in order to get some good experience, when I was completing my psych degree, I worked on the door of many a nightclub in Melbourne and dealt with all sorts of walks of personality. I guess for money, obviously, and get myself through uni. And it was a good job of just working and dealing with a whole different range of people and personalities and alcohol and drugs. And I worked in a very fine establishment that had its fair share of some issues. And after I completed my psych degree, then I went into the world of child protection and spent about 5 years working in child protection.
Was there something in your psych degree that made you want to do that? Or was it again just you drifted from sort of one security bouncer related job to,
to another? I worked at Dandenong Psychiatric Centre. I did work experience there, and I always thought I wanted to do clinical work. But I realised I did not want to do clinical work. I found it really challenging and really confronting, and I found it probably really quite scary at the time. And what I realised
Well, how old were you?
I was only 21, 22.
At Dandenong
Psychiatric Centre.
Yeah.
It was full on. But what I did realise is I really enjoyed, I thought maybe working with children before it gets to that level of mental health and that level of breakdown and whether or not I could make any difference in that space.
Yeah.
So I went into child protection and I worked with the Adolescent Protective Team out in Narre Warren, and I dealt with a whole range of adolescents, and I thought I knew adolescents because I had been one.
Yeah.
And I realised very quickly I did not know these kind of adolescents. Like, these kids could teach me things in an hour that I would take a lifetime to learn. And
things about the street.
Yeah, like a lot. Mm. And just some of the stories they shared and some of the issues they had. And I did. I learned a lot. I made some big mistakes very early on. And
like what?
The one that comes to mind is I actually was working in Gippsland, and I was working in the office in Warrigal, and I took a phone call from a young girl who had been removed from her father's care because of physical and sexual abuse.
Mm.
So it was a pretty sad case, but she was at her father's home, and she rang me saying, "Oh, I need to get out of here. And I didn't even know why she was back there. And her father and her had been drinking. She was 13.
Yeah.
And I said to another worker, let's go down and we'll take her back to her mum's. And the other worker at the time lived in Traralgon and I lived in Berwick. So we decided to take two cars and go down there and just assess the situation and take her back to her mum's, which sounds all quite simple. But I think what I realised very quickly is how wrong that went, because by the time I got there, dad and daughter had reunited and were sitting on the front lawn with a bottle of Jack Daniels and a bottle of Jim Beam. And they were both heavily intoxicated.
Mm.
And this is in the days before mobile phones, and we hadn't even rang the mum to see if she could go back there. So we asked to use their phone and we went inside the house, and unbeknownst to us, the father had two of his near friends inside who were recently released from prison, and they weren't too happy about child protection being in their home or in their mate's house. And we rang the mother to say, we'll bring back the daughter. And she said, no, I don't want to. And we went, oh, my God. And I remember thinking, how do I tell this child that her mother doesn't want her? And we, the father who had physically and sexually abused her was the only one that was sitting here. And it was at that point I thought, why didn't I ring the mum before I left to make sure and come up with an alternative?
Mm.
And father and daughter got into this almighty altercation, yelling at each other. And the two of his mates became involved. And I remember thinking, oh, no, we're in the middle of this very small house. And we went outside. I managed to get
out. Who was your partner? So
another child protection worker, female.
Female, yeah.
And I said to her, name was Jackie. And I said, look, it's really hot in here. Let's go outside. And we went outside. And father and daughter were at each other's throat. And next thing, it just went off. And we were in a part of Maui where there was clients that lived sort of nearly in every house. And father and daughter started physically punching on, going for it. And I remember thinking, I'll intervene. And I went to intervene. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw the two mates from inside coming out, one with a baseball bat and one with a knife. And I remember, I think I had big clogs on at the time, and I said, run. And it was before the days of keyless entry, so we couldn't get the key into the car. We had two separate cars, and we went to run into a house, and it was another DHHS client who said, you're not coming in here, you dogs. So we kept running and running, and by the time we got to somewhere safe and we used someone's phone, we rang the police, and they said, yep, we know where you are. We'll come and send a car. And by the time we got back around to the client's house, my Govvy car had been set on fire. They'd put a petrol bomb in it. So the fire brigade was there trying to deal with my car. And her Govvy car had been completely smashed with the baseball bat, the windows, everything like that. And there was a siege inside the house with the two friends. The father and daughter had been arrested. And there was the police helicopter and the media was there. And I remember thinking, how am I going to write up the incident report on this? And it was an example, I guess, of not doing your homework before you get there. Like, I didn't contact the mum. We didn't have a plan. We didn't put anything into any sort of structure. And
no.
We just thought we'd go there, the daughter would go back to the mum, and that would be it.
Even alerting the police, finding out some background about...
Yeah.
And not even, I guess, when you rock up, there might have been another car in the driveway belonging to the guys who turned up.
Absolutely. And there was, to even go into their home, we didn't even, had never been inside the home.
Yeah.
We were barricaded. We didn't have any communication strategy between us because we arrived in two separate cars.
Yeah.
Because to be honest, Tony, really honestly, and if I'm being brutal, I think what I was thinking is, oh, well, you live in Traralgon and I live in Berwick. We'll just go here, sort this out, and then we go home and we'll have a nice day. And it was more just around thinking how I was going to get home for the day, which sounds, as I said, you learn through error as a mistake, whereas I didn't get home till nearly midnight that night. But it was just one of those ones that I had to look back and think that could have been managed so much better. So there was lots of experiences in child protection and dealing with parents. And I look back now, though, and I really do think I would make a much better child protection worker now than what I did back then, because I had no idea. I had no children. I had no experience and very little life experience. I knew the theory in the books, but the practicality wasn't there. And so,
isn't that the case, though, with anything? You look back. Is there one area in your life you wouldn't be better at, except maybe running around the block?
Yeah.
You know, as a 40-whatever-year-old than as a 20-year-old. I can't think of one area in my life where I wouldn't go back and go, if only I knew then what I know now, I'd be much better. When I joined the job, I was the dope.
Yeah.
You know, and I can look back at that kid and go, that kid knew nothing.
Yeah.
And even with a tactical bent, my tactics were poor.
Yeah.
And then since I've learned more about tactics, probably since I left the police department, but, yeah, I don't think there's one area of my life that I don't that I would look back and go, I'm not better at that now.
Definitely. And I think that's where organisations need to look at really having that broad recruitment process, looking at different markets to tap into. And I think the police have done that well.
Yeah.
In looking at, maybe you don't need to be 6'3" and built like, you know, an Adonis.
Yeah.
You do need different skills. And I think with places like child protection or working in custodial environments or any of those areas, having people with a different skill set. And again, I still look at some areas now, and I think we have a lot of young, inexperienced, and are using child protection again, females predominantly.
Yeah.
That maybe necessarily we do also need to have a broader approach to that recruitment strategy. So
even age.
Yeah, age. Absolutely.
The fact that the police department will now take people in their 50s as recruits.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas, you know, once upon a time they had the 5'8" and 3/4" height limit. You had to be, you know, a male brimming in muscularity and physical peak physical condition, or a female in the same way. But even then, in the old days, I remember it wasn't that long before I joined that female police officers were really only brought on for community policing, that sort of, you know, we're going to go to the cases of domestic violence and we will provide the more emotional support while the men will do the policing.
Yeah.
You know, and it's been a huge shift because that variety, that having all these people with different life experiences from different walks of life themselves, different age groups, different socioeconomic and psychosocial statuses, and you bring them all together, what a wonderful sort of, especially since Melbourne is such a melting pot.
So much. And I think that's it. And so for me, that's always been it was a real growth area though. And I think working in those early days, it was a great learning environment and doing a lot of court work and doing cross-examination and having to write a report that could stand up in court and make some fundamental decisions. I thought that was a great training ground and a learning environment to really develop skills quickly, you know, and so I did sort of child protection and then moved into youth justice and worked in that environment for about 10 years and then decided to move into the more the corporate world or take things a little bit easier and deal with professionals, and I think I should have stayed in the in the prison world perhaps.
Yeah, you might have been deluding yourself there.
Maybe, because I think it's similar in some ways. So,
did your psych background give you any advantages, do you think, with child protection and youth justice?
No. Nope. I'll be honest, I actually think I probably did the wrong psych degree.
Okay.
I did psych and I got a Bachelor of Arts, a Bachelor of Science with honours in psychology. But I studied at Monash Clayton and it was known as the Stats and Rats course. So it was very, very scientific focused, very much on, you know, Skinner's box of behavioural conditioning and Pavlov's and all of those things. And, yeah, I don't think that necessarily tells you how to cope with the mother who's breaking her heart crying, saying, I need help and, you know, I don't know how to cope, or I'm financially exhausted and emotionally exhausted from these children. So not really, I'll be honest, but I don't know if I did the wrong psych degree, but... And I've got my children now, and my daughter's studying psychology, and I must admit, she's still doing all the same thing, the Skinner's box, Pavlov's dogs, the way light hits the eye, and that's all interesting.
Mm.
But I don't know if it does really give you some of the skills and strategies on how to deal with the emotional fallout of what happens in families. And for me in child protection, it honestly didn't help me. It got me in the front door, and it got me the job. But then the learning really started.
It's interesting, isn't it? But you notice there's all these different branches of psychology now.
Yeah.
Social psychology and moral psychology and positive psychology and behavioural psychology. And I think that what they do is they probably realise somewhere along the way that you can go and do a base medicine course, but you still have to branch off to be more specialist.
Yeah.
Whereas obviously the base psychology course is more a historical understanding of behaviour, behavioural origins.
I mean, Piaget's theory of play, and you do kindergarten and you do all of those things. But, yeah, and look, I think it does. It gives you that foundation. But it was only years later that I remember it was probably 3-4 years into child protection, I do remember for the first time joining the dots between a theory and practice.
Okay.
And that was good old Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And I went, oh, yeah, well, if someone hasn't got food, then shelter, and they're not able to love, and they're not able to have safety, and they're not able to self-actualize. So for me, as a worker, it was, let's get those first two foundations right. There's no point trying to even move to those high levels without that. But that was the first time I ever went, oh, theory, real life, I get it.
Because that helped. They don't, and this is probably the issue, isn't it? That even in our training, we find ourselves going into a workplace, dropping some theory on them, but hoping that we can tie that into a role play, a scenario, or let's watch this footage. This theory must tie to that activity to make it real, to embed in real life. And I find that same thing with Maslow talking exactly like that, where who's going to want to talk about, you know, self-actualization or self-esteem when you're living in a box on the footpath under a bridge, you know? At that moment, they're really after what stops them from freezing to death or dying of starvation or being mugged to death or something. So they're on that base level. They're not even looking here.
And I think that goes to that whole, whether or not in our work, when we deal with high-risk adolescents or you're dealing with individuals who are experiencing drug and alcohol or substance use, I think fundamentally what happens is you have workers or case managers or social workers or psychologists who are in action mode. So let's do this and you can do that. But as you know from the whole cycle of change, like some people are just in contemplation phase. They haven't even decided whether they're going to give up drugs or they haven't even decided if they're going to, you know, stop smoking or do whatever. But we're like, well, you've got to do this and you have to do that. And then we wonder why they say, piss off. No, I'm not turning up to counselling.
Yeah.
And that's the whole, I guess, system with the courts as well, where people are mandated to do drug and alcohol, mandated to do get work, mandated to do X, Y, and Z. But if they're just looking at how am I going to stay warm for the night, they're not in that place. And that's the ongoing frustration. And it becomes, I don't know, you know, I've been working in that sector now for nearly 18 years. And sometimes I think it's the same stuff over and over. And we don't see, and sometimes maybe the change won't come for another 10 years when we're no longer even working with that client. That the penny may drop and they say, wow, now I get it.
Yeah.
But workers aren't there anymore. We don't see the good outcome. All it feels like is the return users to some degree.
The churn. Yeah.
The churn.
You're in it. You're almost a hamster in a wheel.
Yeah.
And you don't see anything coming as a result of that wheel turning.
And that's what happened to me, I think, when I worked with the Victorian Sex Offender Program. I think there came that point where I just thought, this is the same thing. Are we having any successful outcomes? And it was sort of at that point where I thought, I'm going to go down a different path and maybe move into organisational psychology, which I enjoy better than perhaps doing sort of more the social psychology and a bit of the counselling and clinical work.
Well, I mean, you certainly made a career of it.
Mm.
Do you find yourself frustrated by, if I was to throw this open-ended question, do you find yourself, or what do you find yourself frustrated by when you think about the way organisations organise their training and the focus that they put on the training of their people to understand all these issues?
I get frustrated on two levels. I think often it's viewed as a bit of a quick fix, you know. So when I do training, I come in and I deliver a workshop, and sometimes I'll say, you've got a 3-hour window and we'd really like you to teach them, you know, A, B and C, but can you also give them some feedback that their current behaviours or their skills are not where they need to be and that they're causing some trouble in the workplace with some of their colleagues? That's not my job.
No.
And I do find organisations or managers will use training or trainers as almost a process of performance management, and that's not what it should be about. So that would be one of my frustrations. But secondly, the other part is, to some degree, when we're involved in any form of training, you I love it when I'm involved at least in a recruitment aspect and we get the right people and a job fit. And then in the induction process, so you can give them some basic foundational skills and then a refresher where you do that over a year and that person has ongoing professional development. And that's coupled then with their line management and we have a voice into that area so that we can then say, hey, these are some areas we've noticed in training and they can say, here's some things we're seeing on the floor. Can we work together in doing some coaching? I think that makes a beautiful process.
Mm.
It requires time, it requires funds and commitment and the resources, and that's where organisations then go, yeah, that sounds great, that sounds really good, but if you could just do half a day of training, that would be greatly appreciated. And as a consultant, you go, okay, all right, I'll do it, but don't expect the rainbow and cupcake outcome that you're looking for.
And it is that very much that values continuum, isn't it? One end, you can see there's a real disparity between what an organisation wants and what we really know they need.
Yeah.
And then on the other end, you go, I've got to put bread on the table.
That's it.
So you only want to pay me for half a day. All right.
Okay. That's, I'm in and out.
Yes, and I'm in and out. There is some sort of utility to that. There's some advantages for us. But also I think that there's, you know, if you're going to develop a long-term relationship with a group, any client, they want to see some sort of real change. Have you had anybody saying to you lately, can you show us any statistics or any evidence that you've made real change in the organisations you've worked with?
Mm.
I find that odd
because
how much change do you want for the dollar and 50 cents you're paying?
That's right.
Mm.
I'm more than happy to do a longitudinal study. And you know, I know you and I have done work in that space before where we've looked at environments of high risk and looked at the number of incidents there's been and the nature of those incidents, and then we've monitored whether they've dropped off or whether there's been any attitudinal change and whether or not then you've got a focus group who oversees that and whether we're meeting it. But again, it's sometimes organisations become slack or there's a turnover of staff. And you're right, then they're saying, well, how will you guarantee me some change for a half a day session? Well, I probably won't, but I'll probably be able to give you a good post-training evaluation report that they enjoyed the training.
Yes.
And hopefully they pick up one or two things from it. As you said, you get your bang for your buck, but that's about it. So it is, it's a real conundrum that sits there.
It is. I don't think there's any way I've found to be able to describe to any organisation that, okay, let's just label, you want a 90-minute lecture on a subject.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's going to be information that something exists. Yeah. I'm going to talk about the existence of some theories, but you're not even going to really understand those theories that I'm talking about at the end of the 90 minutes. Then we go to half a day and I'll go, okay, you are going to understand one of those theories at a mild level, but you're not going to really be able to use it.
Yeah.
We'll go to a full day of training. You're going to understand and be able to use one or two theories at the end of today. Then we go into multiple days or refresher programs or broader campaigns, as you were describing earlier. And then you can say, you're not only going to understand it, you'll be able to utilize several of those things that we've discussed. And that's when you start to see change.
Yeah.
But, you know, even a series of lectures or half-day training programs, you know, you're deluding yourself here if you're expecting huge organizational change and behavioral change as a result of that, and your statistics are going to reflect that.
I've got an organization I'm working with at the moment, and so I've sort of moved away from that area of high risk environment, but working with teams in conflict or individuals in conflict within teams. And I've got two teams at the moment, but one team I met with, and but it was interesting, like they've brought me in and they've been having problems for 5 years in this organisation with the same people, the same names. And so now I've come in and I've done a briefing with them, and I'm now basically, I've given them a piece of paper to say, look, here are our values. This is the code of conduct. First step would be you sign this form, and that says you're prepared to at least sign up to a basic level of behaviour. And then following that, are you prepared to work with people in this team? And now I would facilitate some mediations between these key players and then monitor them over a period of time. So the first step is just putting your name to this piece of paper that says, I'm prepared to at least adhere to the code of conduct. Well, the same eight people who have been problematic for the last 5 years and are still problematic refuse to sign the paperwork.
Right.
So I'm on one hand saying, look, I'm more than happy to do mediations, consulting, projects, but there's a quick answer here.
Yeah.
They're the problem. They're still the problem. They're not signing the paper. When does the organisation say this is no longer the place for you?
Mm.
And the organisation's like, but we're not prepared to do that. Well, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different outcome. I don't have a magic wand.
Mm.
So you either hold people accountable or not. Mm. And so if we're wanting that behavioural change and that cultural change within this organisation, unfortunately, I think there has to be some departures along the way to show that, because if we have the same players and we're in the same sandpit, we're going to have the same game playing, and that's what's occurring at the moment. So it's interesting when you bring in a consultant, but A, don't be prepared to do anything internally, is a real frustration. It's a real frustration.
Isn't it interesting that, first of all, organize to go kind of tangential for a moment, that organizations will hire someone like you after the ship has hit the sand,
mm-hmm.
not only after it's hit the sand, but after it hit the sand 5 years ago.
Absolutely.
And it's been constantly hitting the sand for 5 years.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, we've got a new team together, why don't we get a team and leadership expert
mm-hmm.
in to make them cohesive from the start. And then let's, once they're cohered, now let's set them forth on this glorious journey.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the first problem. So there's an under communication and team at work is undervalued in the workplace for a start. The second thing is they wait 5 years. The third thing is they don't marry it up to any policy, so that you've got all these policies and hiring and firing policies and performance management policies and complaints and grievances policies that in no way align with your training.
Yep.
And then they'll go, but it's all over to you.
Yeah.
And then we want you to create real change. Yeah, and so
it is. It's a real frustration, and that's exactly where I'm at. And I, you know, if I look at any sort of work around changing culture, you know, you focus on those four aspects. First and foremost, leadership.
Mm.
So what's the leadership now? If the leadership and the leadership in this organisation has remained the same in this team, has there been any performance management? What action plans? What strategies have been put into place?
Mm.
Do we have to change the leadership to get some different outcomes? What's our recruitment methodology? So that's not occurring. Secondly, policies and procedures and processes. You know, we've had formal complaints levelled at each person. Well, what's the investigation process? What's been the finding? What is your, you've got a code of conduct. You've got that specified about what behaviours are acceptable. Link behaviours to remuneration rather than just how much dollars you're bringing in, and I bet you'll see some changes. Symbols, symbolically, let's change up the team. Let's change even the dynamics that exist within the team, and just the behaviours that we're prepared to tolerate. So those four factors all need to be examined. But to just think you're going to bring in an external consultant and they're going to make a magic wand. And I often say to the teams I work with who are in conflict, do not think I've got a magic wand. And secondly, I didn't get you into this mess. You did.
Yeah.
So the only people that really can get you out of it are you, and whether or not you're going to sign up for this process. And there's a real, you know, and I had somebody say to me a couple of weeks ago who I'm working with, oh, good luck, you're going to need it. And my response was, I don't need luck. It doesn't impact me.
No.
I'm not part of this team. But the people who need luck is this team, because surely, and I often think about this, nobody wants to go to work every day and be miserable and get that feeling on a Sunday night that they have to go into the workplace. And it's a bit like the high school bullying behaviour, and it transcends into the workplace, and it really does have a physical and psychological impact on people.
But productivity and morale.
And productivity and absenteeism and workplace morale and the degree of game playing that goes on, and it's exhausting, and nobody wants it. Everybody doesn't want it. But everyone's contributing to that escalation, and no one's prepared to change it up. So I think that's a dilemma that workplaces are currently struggling with.
Isn't it interesting that all eight of those people have virtually signed a paper to say, I'm buying into the conflict?
Yeah.
But they won't sign a paper that says, I want to buy out.
Absolutely.
I find that fascinating. Yeah. So they are tacitly saying, I'm okay with what's going on.
Yeah.
I'm okay with the stress on a Sunday night, the absenteeism, the low stress, the high stress and low morale and low productivity and the conflict and the constant feeling in my chest. I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
But don't put a paper in front of me that says we can sign up for something that will lead us towards a better place.
Yeah, towards resolution towards just, you know, and I often use this expression, and it's my father lived his whole life by this philosophy, and I love it, and I've tried to teach it with my daughters. It's nice to be nice and it costs you nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
And,
right.
And I think, you know, I've read so many code of conduct and behaviours and values and visions and all of that, but at the end of the day, it's nice to be nice and it does cost nothing. And it's the amount of energy it takes to make someone's life miserable. And so really what we're saying is, well, so I just don't want to be nice. I don't want to treat you with respect or courtesy, or because there's only one person we can control, ourselves. So if you're not prepared to say that's what you can do, then basically what you're doing is 100% right, Tony. You're signing a fake piece of paper that says, no, I'm just going to be an asshole.
Yes, forever.
I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be nice. And it's odd, isn't it? Invisible paper. So,
and how do you as a trainer turn up and affect anyone's values? You know, you can have a conversation about, and one of the things that people reject almost offhand is any suggestion that their beliefs and values are
wrong
or even modifiable.
Yeah.
You know, let alone to the degree where you and I can have a conversation and go, whoa, that's ridiculous. But they're holding on to those values as if they were born with them and they're going to die with them, damn it. I find it really odd. I find it bizarre in the world today that people are not even prepared to self-examine at all. Like, you know, if I could, I often say this, it's a bit glib, you know, I'm flippant. I could fly an aeroplane across the world and just crop dust a bit of insight, just a bit of an ability to self-reflect. Who are you? Why are you like that? And is it really actually what you should be? You know, could do you think there might be a little bit of a way that you could be nice? You know,
something a little bit different. So.
Yeah. If and not only that, they're it's clearly affecting their own lives.
Yeah.
Because you and I probably both worked in places where it hasn't been fun, but we've probably both worked in places that have been fantastic, where you wake up and you go, oh, cool.
Yeah.
I like going to work.
Yeah.
This is going to be great. Why not do that every day?
I know. And it's for some reason, I guess, for many people who are wounded in that way, especially in the corporate world or the professional world, and I'm not talking clients with trauma and attachment disorder and some emotional baggage. But, you know, individuals who are fairly buoyant and live a life and are there getting paid to work, then I guess it does often come down to that thing where they feel to some degree someone's, trodden on their values or disrespected them or treated them in some way that's badly. And then that sort of just gets lost in the process where they almost are convinced that the person's out to get them, and they get that tunnel vision and they just feel that the world is out to get them no matter what. And then they feel the organization's out to get them.
Oh, yes.
And then their language shifts from, you know, I really love this place and we do this, and to they and us and me and them. And, you know, people will say things like, you know, well, this organization or this place, well, that's who you are. You're part of it. And they almost disconnect, and there's this real disconnection between themselves and the way in which they're what attracted them to work for this organization are now getting lost in translation. And I think that's, you know, and then they really do, it manifests itself then. And that's where I find, regardless of any client I'm dealing with, that then trickles into their personal life, and it doesn't finish at 5 o'clock. And they literally then will start self-medicating on all the things they shouldn't and that doesn't help them feel better, and then their sleep becomes disturbed, and then their relationships become broken and fragmented, and then do that for longer than 3 months, they wake up and then they're going to work in that really negative, cynical, bitter, miserable headspace. And then I do believe emotions are contagious.
Of course.
So then you get what you give, and you walk in and you're grumpy, and the cycle has then got
especially oxygen. If they're quite an influencing sort of a character, yeah. Which a lot of negative and cynical people can be. They tend to create fear in other people. Oh, I don't want to be on the end of that tongue lashing. Yeah. This person's got a laser tongue, and I don't want to be part of, I don't want to be sliced up. So I'm going to buddy up to that person.
Absolutely. Just agree.
It's better to agree. I'm just going to get along. I'm going to be part of that.
Yeah.
And I notice that other people are starting to sort of be drawn to that as if the person's Velcro, everyone's sticking on them. I'd better do that because I don't want to be seen as part of the out group. And now, but God, it's horrible in here, but I'd better stay.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating that they're marinating in it.
Mm.
You know, you can feel that they're almost at home and they're marinating in their own self-pity and wallowing in it and waking up the next morning and they're completely stewed overnight in the home of it. Then they go to work and they cook themselves more in it, and they go home and stew more and go to work and cook. Oh.
And when I do any work in resilience and that area of emotional intelligence that we spoke about, and, you know, I do a fair amount of work in a number of areas, and one of the workshops I do is resilience and self-care, and people say, but can you just tell me what to do so that I'm resilient, so that I can bounce back and so I can get out of this.
Plug this in.
Yeah, and, like there's almost a mathematical formula that will give you that outcome.
Just add water.
And it's, and that's the part where we all know what we should do.
Mm.
We do, but it's the degree to which you're prepared to do it at any particular time and that you're aware about it and you're prepared to make some differences. And that's often the really hard part for many people. But, you know, I think it often comes down to those four areas of physical well-being, emotional well-being, mental well-being, and your soulful or spiritual well-being. And if you've got them in check, then you can maybe elaborate to occupational wellness, financial wellness, you know, whatever takes your fancy in that educative wellness.
Mm.
But you need those basics, those four areas of physical, emotional, mental, and soulful or spiritual.
You feel like each one of those just simply requires a platform. Let's just stabilize each one of those for now.
Yeah.
That even if we don't say we're going to move you out of it, we're not even aiming at thriving yet. You know, if we look at each of those cups as part of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, let's just stabilize the cup in the safety and security. So the safety of your physical well-being, let's just get you understanding that drink more water, get more sleep, eat better food or stay away from the junk food. And okay, baby steps.
Yep.
So I'm not saying cut all sugar, all salt, all fat, cut it, because they'll have, for a start, they'll have a mental breakdown. But let's go one meal a week less junk food and replace that with something really healthy.
Yeah.
Drink two more cups of water a day.
Mm-hmm.
Get half an hour more sleep. So put Netflix aside, go to bed earlier, read a book, go to sleep. Now, let's just stabilize that physical.
Yeah.
Now, probably having done that, it will have a big bearing on the emotional.
Absolutely.
Now, what can we do to further stabilize the emotional? Yeah. Well, reconnect with a friend, with your parents, do stuff, catch up with friends more often. Yeah,
grateful journal. And I know
grateful journal.
For some people, they often think, oh, well, that doesn't work for me. And they're right, because what works for me may not necessarily work for you.
Mm.
You go out and do all your Kempo and things. I'll do boxing or I might go run or a walk, but, you know, we need to do what works for us. So that's number one. But I think at the end of the day, the big thing I often say is resilient people recognize patterns. So you know when you feel good and you're able to sustain and keep that going. You know when you're not in a good space and you change it up.
Yeah.
But if you don't actually recognize the pattern, then you're already a step behind. So I love what you just said about, okay, maybe it's just the physical, you know, and then, okay, maybe a grateful journal doesn't work for me, but I'll give it a go just for a period to see if it makes me shift in my mood.
Mm.
You know, I'll put some, I'll become aware of what my mood moderators are, whatever they may be. For some people, it's music. For some people, it's dance. For some people, it's watching a comedy show. For some people, it's catching up with friends. Whatever your mood moderators are, but you become consciously aware of that and you plug into it. And I think just doing those things in those, as you said, those four cuts, you don't have to be perfect at it, but we know, and I know for a fact personally, when I start dropping the balls and start to feel overwhelmed and that my emotions are in control of me rather than me in control of the emotions, often my cups are depleted.
Yeah.
You know, my physical goes, my emotional goes, I'm not doing things to nourish my soul, whether that's just little things, random acts of kindness or a bit of volunteering or spending time in nature. So you therefore not become present, you're on autopilot, and all of a sudden then we just don't know. And that's when resilience and people say to me, oh, but you don't know what I've been through lately. You know, I've had all these factors influencing me. Everybody's got factors.
Yeah.
Look at COVID-19 at the moment, my God. And everybody is – I read an article the other day about being tired and wired at the moment.
Yeah.
And I really like that. I thought – and it's because we've got these two emotions of fatigue and anxiety coexisting with each other.
Yeah.
So we're tired, but we're anxious because everything's uncertain. Mm. We don't know. We're trying to keep our head above the water. We're trying to get ahead of the game. But every day the balls are changing.
Mm.
So you have to focus on, well, what can I control? And, you know, the fatigue element of, am I getting the right sleep?
Yeah.
And am I doing what I can to nourish myself physically and emotionally? That's in my control. It is.
Yes.
COVID-19 is not in my control at the moment. No. But that is. So these.
Isn't that interesting that if we're going to stabilize, we can't look externally at the things we can't control? What's the point in that? And I think that COVID is a great example where what's the point of saying, yeah, but COVID, don't worry about COVID.
Yeah.
Go to bed half an hour earlier. Don't. Pick up a book, take it to bed, don't worry about COVID, have a salad.
Yeah.
Don't worry about COVID, go for a run.
Yeah. Turn off the news and put on some music.
Yes.
You know, just
pet your dog.
Yeah.
Hang out with your dog.
Work on your internal environment.
Yeah.
And then you are prepared and able to cope with whatever is thrown in your direction.
Next.
Because there is going to be something. There is. And I was coming here today and my daughter rang me and she's got a friend of hers. I don't know this girl, but I've heard of her, and her mum died 12 months ago. She's only 16.
So
her mum died 12 months ago. Well, her father was killed last night.
No way.
Yeah, and this is a 16-year-old girl, she's got a 12-year-old sister and a 9-year-old son.
Brother.
So I just, my heart broke from it, and that's tough, and that's, and again, you can't control that. That's happened, that's gone now, and all you can hope is that that girl has got that internal resilience in terms of how do I make sure I'm okay, because the world is going to deal us some pretty crappy hands, and you know, we've all had factors that hit us. It's whether or not you've got the internal fortitude to be able to manage what life throws in your direction.
How do you feel about, just to interrupt at that moment, how do you feel about the notion of today's society about really wanting to wrap kids in cotton wool and not have them exposed to, do you feel that there's a lot of talk, particularly on social media, about, you know, this softer generation that are very fragile around needing safe spaces and all of that. And how does that juxtaposed with the notion that a pencil is sharpened against something hard.
Yeah.
That we, like a muscle, need to go through stuff in order to be able to go through stuff.
Absolutely. And you know, I completely agree. I think there is a cotton wool generation that is being bred. And, you know, and I used to, even having children, you know, the whole ribbons for just participating. I never really signed up, or not keeping scores and things like that. But that's maybe a personal preference, but resilience is a muscle that can only be flexed during difficult times.
Yes, nice.
And when people say, oh, I'm such a resilient person, but you've never really had adversity in your life or challenging times, how do you know you're really resilient?
Mm.
And I've known friends and loved ones and colleagues where life's been great for them, really good, and they've lived it. And then all of a sudden things have happened, whether it's redundancy, breakdown of a marriage, breakdown of a relationship, death of a parent, illness of a parent is one that I've seen a lot of my friends going through at the moment. And all of a sudden, they're not coping. The balls are getting dropped. And I think, well, maybe they're not as resilient because they've never really had to flex that muscle. And I think you can only do that when it is, when the chips are down, as to how quickly you're able to bounce back. And I don't think you necessarily need to do it alone. I think we do need support. But I think for our kids, that should be our role. I'll be your support, but you have to go through it. I'm yes. your support team. I'm your road crew. I'll be there to make sure you're going to be okay. But you have to experience it. And I always remember my eldest daughter, she's 23, and I think she was maybe 6 or 7, and she was in a swimming carnival and she'd signed up for it, and she, the night before, did not want to go, did not want to do it at all. And I said to her, you've signed up, you said you're doing it. And she goes, I said, what is your biggest fear? I'm going to come last. I said, look, that probably won't happen. It probably won't. But I will be prouder of you if you go in there and you come last yeah. than if you don't go tomorrow.
Yes.
Anyway, she went and I couldn't go. So her father went and she went. And I all day I was so worried about her. And I'd love to say the good ending of the story where she came first. No, she came last by about a whole pool. And when she got out, the tears were blinding her. And I think she could have killed me at that moment for embarrassment and humiliation. Luckily, I wasn't there. But to this day, she talks about that. And she doesn't say it was pleasant, because it wasn't.
No.
But I can guarantee it set her up in terms of just other experiences that this too shall pass.
Yes.
And you learn from it. And it's not the end of the world.
And that's what she learned.
And that's what she learned.
She didn't lose a birthday. She's no...
She's fine. And she's a very successful, competent, capable, beautiful young woman now.
Yep.
And I think they're the little lessons. Whereas the easy thing for me that night would have been, yeah, babe, don't worry, and just hold her.
Yes.
Now, if she was an anxious kid with a lot of problems and concerns, and I really think it was going to take a toll on her, I would have not thrown her in literally the deep end. But it wasn't that. It was just she didn't want to be outside her comfort zone. And that's where you have to learn, you know. And we do learn outside of it. It is. That's where that growth is. Mm. Is it scary? Yeah. But that's where the growth is.
I think as well with kids, you go, all right, you as a parent, you always feel scared letting them off the chain.
Yep.
So you don't. You just go, this is one of those leashes that has the windy,
yes.
you know, and it extends. It yeah. So I'm going to put a peg in the ground here at home.
Yeah.
And you've always got a home base.
That's nice.
But you should go out and let that leash go and experience. And if it's too much, then you've got something that you can wheel, you can wind back in home.
Yeah.
But then you go out again and go a bit further.
Yeah.
And when it becomes, but test yourself and challenge yourself and face that adversity knowing that you've got a peg here at home.
Nice.
And I think that it's ridiculous to say don't wander too far.
Mm.
Go until you can't go.
Yeah.
Go until you go, holy shit, I wasn't prepared for this. Turn around, come home into a loving embrace, knowing that you've got that support, but launch from there again and keep launching.
Yep.
Keep launching like a bird out of a nest until you can fly on your own and then come back and visit every now and again.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm not a fan of the, I've never been a fan of the, here's the other thing that strikes me, the kids come home and there's no scores on the scoreboard, but the kids will tell you, oh yeah, we got thrashed today.
Yeah.
They kicked 8 goals and we kicked 1.
They know.
They're counting. So it's not like all the kids are going, oh, I think it was a draw.
Yeah.
They know they got beaten and they're okay with it.
Yeah.
And sometimes they laugh and sometimes they're upset and down, but they're getting over it. They're getting through it. And, you know, Charlie's had some really close matches in really important football games and, you know, at the end of it they lose and he come away with bitter disappointment. Then they might shed a tear. And I know I did when I was growing up and played footy and you lose in a grand final. You just... You spend an entire season and you're devastated gutted. And you're gutted.
Yeah.
You turn up next year, don't you?
Yeah.
To do it all again and with the likelihood you're going to get gutted.
Yeah.
Same thing with love, you know, you're beating your head against a wall, you have devastation, and then you have elation, and then you have devastation, and then you lurch from one uncomfortable moment to the next and all that, and then finally you go, okay, there it is. But along the way, you develop that ability to cope.
Yeah.
And that's what it's about. It's just about.
And I think then that goes through every aspect of your life, really, uh-huh. and that stability and that... just trying, and at the end of the day, you know, what's the old expression, you know, life is not a dress rehearsal, and it's,
you're in it.
Just give it a go, and I often say, what's the worst that's going to happen, you know, and if I can live with tomorrow being on the front page of a news line, if that's, and I think, oh, okay, I've made the best decisions I could in that moment, and fundamentally make some hard decisions, but operate from a place of authenticity and respect and values, then nice. I don't think we're going to get it that wrong, you know, and people are very risk averse. Oh, you can't do this, you can't do that. And maybe it's because we live in such a litigious society now and all the rest of it. But I don't know. I think the essence at the end of the day, I think it boils down to just good communication, whether internally in families, in teams, in workplaces, or dealing with high risk adolescents. People just want respectful, honest communication.
That's right.
And saying, and I think everyone also wants to feel, look, give me some choices. You know, give me some choices. I could feel, whether it be kids, whether it be professionals, whether it be families, if people feel cornered and that they've got no out, that they'll often start fighting, or they'll push back, and you get that resistance. Whereas if you can give someone an option or an out or an opportunity to save face and do it with respect, most people are going to go, you're right, I'm going to do this. Okay, that's your choice.
Because you've shown yourself as being a decent person, and I'm not in combat with you at the moment.
You into this. Yeah. You know, and that's even the work I've done with teams. And I said, this team I was dealing with the other night, and I said, you've got a choice. And I'm not saying it's a palatable choice, but this is the choice. Get in on this process, or maybe this just isn't for you anymore. And I know that's a confronting choice for people, but sometimes you've got to say, maybe this just isn't for me, because what I want is unrealistic. And I often find people will say to me in workplaces, or especially in workplaces, I want this. I want Tony Anger sacked, and I want an investigation, and I want them charged. Well, I'm sorry, I know you feel so wronged, but there's no evidence, and it's not going to happen.
Mm.
So let's go to what's realistic. One, you can work with him. Two, we can do a mediation. Or three, you get to say, I'm not doing any of that, jam your job. Which one is it going to be?
That's right.
So sometimes, but I think if we just give kids an out and allow them a bit of choice, that I love that analogy you said about the peg, and the same as anyone, I'll give you an anchor, I'll give you a safe place, but you have to make some decisions yourself as well.
Yeah, and I think even adults can – do you feel like there's a sense in which people in modern society feel entitled to something that probably a couple of generations ago, nobody would have said that. I want him fired or I leave, you know, that sort of I'm super important, he's looked at me the wrong way, or she's, whatever it is, looked at me the wrong way, and I have the right not to be looked at in that manner. I want them gone. Like, hold on a second.
I think there's a lot of, I don't know, there is a fair bit of at the moment of, and I do feel this, and again, this is sort of something I do a lot of work in, discrimination and equality and harassment and bullying. But I do feel at the moment within Australia, and I know a number of people do, but if you express your views of what you want and it is in keeping with the political view of, you know, whatever the current sort of trend is, then you're allowed to say that. But if you do say something that is at odds with that, you can be persecuted as well. So there's this real...
call-out culture.
Yeah, it is. And I can understand why people go, I'm not going to say anything.
Mm-hmm.
But you said before, but how, I don't have the right to tell you what your values are and what your views are, unless they're illegal, you know, and they're breaching moral or, you know, ethical or legal principles. But, you know, but it's a fine line, because people do say, I want all the rights, but I don't want any of the responsibilities that come with that.
Yeah.
And
yeah, so in a workplace conflict situation like that organisation you were dealing with before, they're wanting their needs met.
Yeah.
Without wanting to engage in the responsibilities that make those needs
That's
be met.
That's right. And the responsibility that you owe other people in terms of making some modifications to your behaviour around that. And
a lot of resilient stuff is stopping pointing the finger.
Yeah.
Just stop blaming, that blame culture. You're not doing this for me. Like you were saying, this place I've got to work in, us and them, they're not doing for me. Well, hang on. Like John F. Kennedy said, you know, ask not what the country can do for you. Ask not what your organisation can do for you. What are you doing to make this a better workplace? Because at the end of the day, you can say, I come here and I bust a gut for 8 hours. But the organisation can say, hold on, we pay you money to do that. So it's not a favour that you're doing us. We've hired you out of 160 applicants.
Yeah.
You got the job. You could be 150.
I want some things in return.
And could one of them be not making the place a worse place to work for everyone else? I don't think that's too much to ask for. And I think in today's society where people are likely to hop from job to job, you know, where I've started with this organisation, but the bloke next door is offering $1 an hour more, so screw you, pal, I'm going next door. That's the sort of loyalty that's being built up around that. But I think people are getting it wrong. That you are lucky to have a job.
Mm.
And in COVID, there are many, many people now who are swimming on the poverty line.
Yeah.
And that's really hard yakka. So for those that have a job and have managed to maintain their income through this period, they should be very, very grateful.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right. It's like when you say, you know, a job is a privilege. It's not a right.
Yes.
And I do think that sometimes we lose that. And I think we live in a very lucky country. We really do. I think we live in the best country, and we are so fortunate when you look at what else is going on around the world at the moment. But I find sometimes individuals that I work with in workplaces have been in that workplace for maybe 15, 20 years, and they've almost lost sight of what it's like in the other real world.
That's right.
So, you know, I sometimes have to share with them, hey, this workplace isn't that bad. You know, what you have here, the conditions, the pay, the environment you work within is all pretty good compared to some other places. Mm. And people often lose sight of that because, and maybe that's through no fault of their own, because they haven't actually, you don't know what you don't know.
We're all in our own bubble, aren't we?
So, to some degree, that may manifest itself, and you have to give a bit of a reality check and check that those distorted thinking patterns that people have. Mm. But I think if you've got somebody who's got some good insight and self-awareness, they're prepared to take that on. It's when people just want to live in denial, anger, blame, justification, that they just sit in that real below the line and below the water activity that ultimately, I often say, who's the only person it really impacts is yourself. Mm. And so hopefully, I don't know, if people can make that mindset shift, I think that's when the breakthroughs occur. Whether that be working with families who are experiencing trauma and challenges, or individuals or professionals, it's all about making the mindset shift. And I think it goes back to the mindset shift of self-actualization of physical, emotional, mental and spiritual that says, I'm the master of my own ship here.
Yeah.
Let's start steering it in a healthier place than the unhealthy patterns that I am. Mm. And if you can make that shift then and get supports around that, then people feel that there's a sense of freedom that comes.
I think as well, for you and I, the nice thing about bringing it back to those foundational levels is it becomes pretty apparent that the people who are balking against that, who are railing against that, simply don't want to.
Mm.
And so it allows us to go, there's nothing I can do now. I'm only brought in to give information for the people who are prepared to absorb it. You can lead a horse to water.
Yep.
Can't force them to drink it.
That's right.
So being able to say, let's just get everything back to base level, your physical, your emotional, your mental, spiritual. If they say, I don't want to, okay.
Yeah.
See ya.
Yeah.
But, you know, it. So it's nice from a trainer's perspective.
I don't want to, Can you just do it for me? No.
Yeah, no.
I can't.
How
sorry.
Odd is that?
But that's often what a number of people think is, well, somebody has to fix this for me. And it's not, it just doesn't work that way. So.
Yeah, but the thing that I find is the most obvious of those, there are many examples, but I've had quite a few people say, that's who I am and I'm not going to change. Yeah. I am who I am, and if you don't like it, you can lump it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, hang on a second. You're saying to me at this moment that there's possibly a better version of you, or maybe a version of you that other people might find more palatable, but you're not prepared to modify anything about you to be more acceptable to others.
Yeah.
Just out of stubbornness. Is that what I'm hearing? Just a belligerent sort of...
Yep.
Yeah. And I find that to be one of the most...
Yeah, I've had that a few times where people have said, can't teach an old dog new trick. This is me. Like it, lump it, or loathe me. I'm not changing for anyone. And I often say, okay... All right, well, you're self-aware, but you're not prepared to make any shift or change in the self-management. You know, there's no social awareness that, okay, know yourself, but if that isn't what's required of a given situation, then you're going to have a problem. So we have to modify and adapt and amend, and that's just called the art of influencing and, you know, minimizing resistance. Rather than just slamming your head against a brick wall and demanding it, it just so people like that I do find quite challenging as well.
They seem to float really happily in one pond.
Yes.
But put them in another pond and they're just at sea.
Yeah.
Because what they want is that cynical pond where people are negative and everybody's happy to sort of spit in the corner and look down their nose at the world and make cynical comments and be negative.
I reminded of a guy I worked with once, and I was doing a training session with him, and he was in the utility sector, and he was adamant, you know, when he went around to people's houses, he would just say to them, well, you know, you just pay your bills and then I don't need to come here. And he would just basically be quite rude and abrasive to individuals. And he'd been assaulted a number of times. And everybody else who worked with him had never been assaulted in this job. And I said to him, well, how's it working for you? And he's going, well, good. I don't care. And I'm like, really? You enjoy going to work every day or being assaulted out of everybody here at the highest rate? Is that really what you're telling me? Well, why should I have to change? Why can't, when people come here to this country, they just follow our ways and pay our bills? And I thought, oh, okay, we're opening up a whole amount of Pandora's box that sits there. But what it did demonstrate is this inability to be flexible and to adapt. And no matter what you said to this individual, he didn't want to make any changes. But the outcome was he was compromising himself physically and emotionally on a daily basis. And humans, I don't think we should be wired for that, you know. We should be... That fight-flight response is that last bastion of hope when you're in imminent danger, not on a daily transactional basis. So.
You know, we're not meant to live in that environment where we go to work knowing that we're going to end up in some horrendous conflict, possibly to the degree where we'll be punched.
Yes. Try and avoid that. That's my golden tip.
What's interesting to me is you would have to go back a long way. You don't have to go back a long way, I beg your pardon, to find that that wasn't the case. That you could go back, I think, probably to the 1950s or 60s, and you wouldn't see too many examples of people like that.
Mm.
Can you imagine your parents, your father going to work and...
My dad was from Glasgow, Scotland, my relatives
are
Scottish. No, I do agree. Like, do you feel... I mean, I feel like road rage, I feel Australians. I mean, I've travelled quite extensively and... You can go to Bali and you can go to other countries where the traffic is a lot more chaotic, but nobody's getting out their car with iron bats and guns. And I just feel we do have this quick response and quickness to anger.
You think that's a community resilience? We've had it so good.
Maybe.
But there's no resilience.
Yeah, our roads. Never flex that muscle.
No. Because our roads, Melbourne has had the best public transport.
Yeah.
Our roads have been fine. And now, because we're getting 60,000 people migrating to Melbourne each year.
Congestion.
And people are losing the plot.
And transport. And it is. It's a losing the plot for what is going on in that minute. And And maybe you're right, we haven't flexed the community resilience, which is a new concept of, around that of, as a community, are we able to, you know, look at that? And I mean, again, let's see what if we get put into a second phase of lockdown, how resilient the community is going to be as well.
Well, we're seeing examples of that now, aren't we, where people are saying, even though they live in the epicentre of the most horrendous COVID examples here in Melbourne, don't you dare lock us down.
Yeah.
And you're going, well, hold on. let's just bring it in and have a discussion about that. You possibly are carrying one of the most lethal viruses that we've had.
We need to do something.
We need to do something. And, you know, people don't understand, and this is a message I hope to get out there more. In any critical incident, you set up perimeters.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're doing. And the police, you know, if it's an assault, you set up perimeters. We set up an inner and an outer perimeter, and we do all that. If it's any critical incident, an oil spill, if it's a chemical spill, if it's a fire, set up perimeters. That's what they're doing.
Yeah.
They're setting up perimeters around this for a contagion. That if it gets out, and how does this contagion get out? By you.
Yeah.
So we have to lock you down.
Yeah.
Why people don't kind of get that.
I think we should almost use that as an ad.
Yeah.
You know, like we could actually design that as an ad to say this is what has to happen at this point in time.
Mm.
And how do we do it in a way that it doesn't therefore, you know, breach the whole, you know, the economy and all the other and take that into account. But at the end of the day, that's exactly right. It is. It's a perimeter and a containment of this particular issue.
That's what they're doing.
And hopefully as a community, our resilience does allow us to, I guess, support one another rather than tear each other apart, you know. And that's, well, we'll wait and see where that's going to go.
So that's an interesting point, and it leads me to another thought about when do we teach and how do we teach socialising, cooperative behaviours, community resilience, good communication skills, because if we have at a community level fundamental things about behaviour and how we get along, forget the workplace. Mm, the workplace is a tiny portion of that.
Yeah.
Every time you're at work, okay, we're at work a third of our lives, and I get all that. We're asleep a third of our lives. The rest of the time we're with family, we're with friends, we're out in the community. That has to be taken into account as well, and we have to have behaviours that befit that third of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So really, I've spent a lot of energy lately just thinking about how do you develop programs not for workplaces, but for the community. To say, you're obviously carrying a lot of angst. That's why you get on public transport and lose the plot.
Yeah.
That's why your kids go to school, they don't get the grade you want, you go into the teachers and you lose the plot.
Yeah.
You're going into an emergency department, you lose the plot. You're going shopping, you lose the plot. You're driving, you lose the plot. Stop losing the plot. Well, how do you develop that muscle? So there must be a way of developing some resilience and some communication skills, some conflict management.
Impulse control.
Self-regulation. please. Some insight. So, you know, again, going back to the cups of resilience and the emotional intelligence model and things like that, but giving people practical skills.
Yeah.
How would we do that?
Gosh, I mean, that's one of those areas around there was a book by, I think her name was Blythe McCarvey, and I've referred to it before, but it just came to me, and she talks about this thing called the FISO factor, F-I-S-O, and it stands for fit in, stand out.
Yeah.
So what she says is if you just fit in the workplace or in society, you never stand out.
Yeah.
So you might get overlooked for a job or promotion or whatever it may be, but if you stand out for all the wrong reasons,
yes,
you never fit in.
Yes.
So what she says is as humans, we have to fit in and stand out at the right time.
Yeah.
So just as you were talking there, for some reason that came to mind about we do need to fit in and all agree on the common goal of a healthy state.
Yes.
And we all need to play our part in that. But we need to stand out, but for the right reasons, not the wrong reasons, not the I'm going to take on the world or kill somebody because I'm not getting my own way, but stand out by acts of kindness.
Yeah.
You know, even just the walking around the neighborhood, I noticed in my neighborhood, you know, at the start of this period, a lot of people did those beautiful, like there was chalk drawings everywhere of rainbows and harmony and love and just on the pathway that kids had done. And it did feel you were a lot more in this together, and those acts of kindness of standing out were positive.
Yeah.
And I think we need to do more of that sort of stuff so that we are all realizing we've got a common goal and fit in and stand out for the right reasons. I think if we stand out for the wrong reasons, as Victoria now going crazy or nutty or so, you know, the rest of Australia, it's not going to be a good look for us. So we need to fit in and stand out, if that makes sense.
It does. No, it really does.
And building behaviours around that. And where do you start? And I think you start locally
out. Do we have to set, surely we don't have to write
a policy
that says this is how you do it.
Yeah.
I would hate to think that we as a society have moved away from common sense so far that we somebody has to actually write a policy that says this is how you do that, by the way.
Yeah. Wouldn't surprise me though. There might be a government grant that comes up that's, that puts out, we want some trainers on how to teach people how to be nice. But I go to my dad's philosophy, it's nice to be nice and it costs you nothing. So look for just those basic acts.
I read years ago, it's nice to be important. It's more important to be nice.
There you go.
And same sort of thing. Yes, same variation. It's a nice variation. But I've used that many times, and I think that's so true. Okay, I get it. You want to be important. There's the standout thing. You want to rise above the crowd. You want to be exceptional at something. But nobody says you have to be exceptional by throwing a brick through a window.
Yeah.
You can be exceptional by being the guy that mended the window for the guy that from the last time it was broken.
Yeah.
For being someone who stops committing crime.
Yeah.
For somebody who's there in support of somebody who needs help. You don't have to be the one that stands out from the crime by being antisocial. You can be very pro-social. And in that way, you stand out, but you also fit in.
And I think that would be it, yeah. Like the pro-social standing out and the communal fit-in that we all feel part of. So
do you think that a lot of people are antisocial because their circumstances lead them to believe that there is no fitting in, no standing out and fitting in?
Mm.
Because it reminds me of, conversations we've had about intergenerational poverty, intergenerational welfare, intergenerational crime. And so when we're dealing with places such as child protection, where it's quite possible that kids grow up, their brothers and father are in prison. And they're in prison because their father, their grandfather, was in prison. They're all on welfare for four generations. They don't understand pro-social qualities at all. It's not part of their makeup. So how do you... And so what they do is they only understand, stand out in an antisocial way and fit in with a tiny percentage of the crowd.
Yeah. And I think that becomes that learned behaviour, and it's, you know, and all we can do is continue to present from a young age other alternative options of a pro-social model, pro-social modelling, role modelling, community connections, and that therefore people then start to see that not all adults are inattentive and abusive, or, you know, that not all homes have these factors that are linked to them, whether it be poverty, drugs, alcohol, and so forth. So you give those options, and I think that's the only way then individuals can learn that there is a pro-social rather than an anti-social model.
Yeah, that's right.
Because, again, it goes back to what we said before. You don't know what you don't know.
No.
If that's your bubble, and I don't know that there's another world out there, then how do you want me to be different if I've never actually seen it? But show me, introduce me to it, let me play with it, give me an opportunity. And I think, you know, we see some amazing growth in young people. But, again, it takes time, you know. It takes a lot of time, and sometimes those changes might not occur until they're 27, 28 and have left the system.
Yeah.
But maybe that's when the change occurs.
Yeah, that's crossed. Right. And that's the whole idea of foster homes and stuff, isn't it? Secure welfare, all those places, is let's just take this kid out of that pond where he's been swimming away with the other ducks who have been in prison and antisocial pond. let's put him in a pro-social pond for a little while and just see if he can at least have his horizons broadened to other potentials. It's a principle in negotiation, of course, that you can't change another person's perspective until you've earned trust enough to create a rapport to introduce options, to have them go, oh, there are options, let me try one.
Yeah.
But it's a process, and as you say, it could take years and years and years. And really, in a child protection, juvenile justice sort of environment, as long as we can, they might be in for 2 years and leave only with the ability to say please and thank you, we've done something.
Yeah.
And now they carry that little aspect of a pro-social pond with them, and hopefully that'll make a difference. Planting a seed, whatever other, you know, crazy analogy you want to use, we've planted a seed and maybe that'll grow and germinate.
See where it goes. Yeah.
Oh, that's tough, isn't it? All right. Well, Les, I'm conscious of your time. We've been sort of nattering on here for a little while.
Thank you.
Can I ask you to just tell everybody where they can get hold of you if people are interested in hearing more from you or engaging your services?
Well, I'm always open to working with you, so you can always contact you. But I now run a company called Edge Consulting and Training Services, and that's I've got our website, www.edgeconsulting.com.au, and my phone number is 0437 744 425. So
very
anytime,
nice.
Or via yourself.
Or via me, yes. Fantastic. And so obviously that people should connect with you on edgeconsulting.com.au if they want to book your services or send you an email. I suppose it's just, what's your email address?
L Whiteside, just WHITESIDE at edgeconsulting.com.au.
Beauty. So L Whiteside at edgeconsulting.com.au. For those of you who want to get into that, and I can highly, highly recommend it. And Les, always amazing to chat with you.
Thank you.
And what's interesting is we've known each other for many years and I sit here and I've just learned stuff. You know what I mean? It's great. It's been wonderful. So thank you for doing that.
No worries. Thanks, Tony.
My pleasure. All right. Thanks, everybody. See you for now. Bye.